Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world. And now your hosts, Yog and Manish.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. This is me, your host, Yagneshwaran Ganesh.
And this is me, Manish Nepal.
All right, in today's episode, we are going to discuss podcasting in B2B marketing. And for that, we have someone who is perhaps one of the most interesting guests we have ever had in our podcast, Christopher Lockhead. As he calls himself, a retired entrepreneur, a three-time public company CMO, and the annoying host of two chart-topping podcasts, Follow Your Different and Lockhead on Marketing. Welcome to the show, Chris. How are you?
Thank you, gentlemen, for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's our pleasure. Chris, you're a marketing rock star, and I'm pretty sure most of the people are already familiar with your background. But just to cover that base nicely, how would you introduce yourself in your own words?
Well, I started off in my business life as an entrepreneur at age 18. I got thrown out of school and did not graduate. At the time, I had no education, no relationships, no experience, certainly no money. I grew up in what you might consider a working class or a very modest kind of a background, if you will, and the product of a single mother. And so at 18 years old, I found myself in a situation where I really had two choices. One was a life of manual labor, and the other was becoming an entrepreneur. And so for me, guys, becoming an entrepreneur was a way up in the world, for sure, but it was really more of a way out of a life of struggle. And that's the incredible thing about entrepreneurship. It is for those of us who find ourselves in a situation where nobody else will bet on you. Becoming an entrepreneur is the way we bet on ourselves. And so I started at a young age. Over time, I ended up being the chief marketing officer of three publicly traded Silicon Valley-based technology companies. At age 28, I sold my boutique consultancy in Canada to a US-based software company and became their head of marketing. And I've been here ever since, which is about 25 years or so. And then I retired from doing all of that in my late 30s, early 40s, and took some time off. And then I started a boutique consultancy. And from there came my first book. And since then, I've written two books, Play Bigger being the first and Niche Down being the second. And as you mentioned off the top, I've started two podcasts. And so really, my life today is one of, I believe if you're lucky enough in life to make it to the top of a mountain, then you should throw down a fucking rope. And so as a guy who started with nothing, and there was no evidence that I would ever be successful, a lot of people helped me along the way, Yag. And so I'm at that place in my life where my motivation today is to give back as much as possible and hopefully have as much fun doing that as possible. And that in a nutshell is my story.
That is an amazing story. We absolutely love that. And today I want to start with a topic that I have never heard you specifically talk about in public, or maybe, not many people have asked you about it. I mean, most podcasts that you appear on tend to have a disclaimer saying that there's going to be some F-bomb, some colorful language, some profanity that listeners should be aware of before they start. And when someone thinks of Christopher Lockhead, they are thinking of radical outspokenness, which may not be everyone's cup of tea. I mean, you yourself have put a testimonial on your website from The Economist that says off-putting to some. And as I've told you before on some of our LinkedIn conversations, is that I see it as a feature and not a bug, because too many people try to be politically too correct to the extent that we don't even feel like we are talking to the real person. So here's my question that I want to dig in. Why is this straightforwardness of throwing truth bombs, the F-bombs and no-nonsense talk such an integral part of all things Christopher Lockhead? I mean, you said you're from Canada and people are generally stereotyped to be the nicest people there. And since you're such a good storyteller, you know, maybe if you can tell us some stories about if this straight shooting got you into trouble, or maybe it landed you out of virtues, what happened?
It's such a fascinating topic. So I don't view it as one of swearing or not swearing or any of that. What it is for me is it's about several things. Probably first and foremost, it's about authenticity. But authenticity connected to my attempt at learning and thinking. One of my favorite expressions is that thinking about thinking is the most important kind of thinking. And so I'm somebody who doesn't necessarily accept the way that it is. I'm somebody who wants to ask, well, why is it like that? Who decided it would work this way? Why are those the rules? Who invented these rules? Do these rules make sense? Do I agree with these rules? Do I think they're full of shit? And as it relates to business, I look at it and go, well, you know, why do certain market categories behave the way they do? Why did Apple just roll out a new pair of headphones that are 2.5 times the price of most headphones? And what are they trying to do? You know, how are they trying to make that work? And so why do market categories work the way they do? How does innovation happen? What makes new innovations be accepted, and what makes some new innovations be rejected? As a result, why are some startups, why are some companies incredibly successful for years and years and years, and others are not? And so these sorts of questions have fascinated me since I was a young man. And I'm not willing to accept the standard answer. What I want is an investigation. And sometimes there are common truths that I think when you pressure test them, end up being wise. And there's some that actually, when you pressure test them, fall apart. And yet they're treated as common wisdom. And so I'm somebody who is willing to investigate. And where I think it's things are right, I'll say it. And if I think things are, garbage, I'll say that too. And then as it relates to communication, I just think, look, it's too hard to try to twist ourselves into being what we think other people think we should be. It's just fucking hard to do that. And so I think the greatest gift we can all give ourselves, and frankly, the world, is to be ourselves. And so I'm not trying to be anything that I'm not. I just am the way that I am. And if that works for some people, that's great. And I know it doesn't work for some people. And that's okay, too. Some people don't like to drink scotch. And that's all right.
Yeah, beautifully said. And one of my favorite top, you know, things on this topic about being direct and you know, being honest and being authentic to yourself is the book that Kim Scott has written about being radically candid. Radical Candor, I think, is the book's name. And I know you have done a podcast with her, and she makes such good points about these things. And I think this is something that is so important, because it saves time for everyone, right? It saves time for you when you're talking about a certain thing, and saves time for the listeners who are getting feedback, for example. So yeah, you're right about being authentic to yourself and being service to others while doing so. Anyways.
And look, you know, the interesting thing is people say, you know, I remember when I started my podcast, there was a very, very big business podcaster who I connected with through a mutual friend. And he sort of said something like, hey, I know you didn't ask me, but I thought I'd give you a little bit of feedback on your podcast. And he said, look, it's really great. Everything about it's really great. He said, you just got one problem. He said, you just swear like an idiot. And he said, a lot of business people are going to find it offensive, and it's going to shrink the size of your audience. And so I kind of know, you know, that's how you like to talk, but you should know, in my professional opinion, it's going to cost you a lot of listeners. You can imagine my response.
Right, right. Well, I would say that's a good filter for finding a product market fit. Anyways, our core topic for today is about podcasting. And it's a fact that podcasts are exploding like anything. I came across one of your recent posts on LinkedIn where you said most podcasts are failures before they launch because of zero category design. And category design is just one among my favorite topics to talk today. Of course, you have covered it abundantly in both of your books that you have co-authored, Niche Down and Play Bigger, if people want to dig deeper into the subject. But here's what I want to ask you next. For brands and individuals who understand the value of category creation but have no clue about how to go about it, what are the 3 to 5 steps you can suggest to them? I mean, is it about calling yourself the number one in particular category, or is it about solving a specific problem for a niche audience, or is it about creating a brand new category by yourself, or can it be all of them put together?
Yeah, it's components of everything you just said. The first sort of aha is this, and this is one that for some people is a little bit jarring, and that is, categories make brands, not the other way around. And in the marketing world, we have massively overcorrected on brand. Brand, 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 brand. We're worshiping at the altar of the brand. And the reality is the category makes the brand. And here's my simple proof. Google has one of the most legendary brands on planet Earth, according to people who measure the value as measured by market cap of a company's brand. They're one of the most powerful brands on the planet. And yet, when they take that brand and they put it on a social network to compete with Facebook, with this thing that at the time they called Google Plus, they literally had their ass handed to them. It cost them over $1 billion. And of course, today, Facebook remains the category queen of social networks, and Google Plus is shut. And so here's my point. The reason Google's brand is one of the most valuable brands in the world is because they're the company that designed and now dominates a giant category that matters. And that category, of course, is search. When they go outside of that category, and they're playing catch up to another company who's designing and dominating a new category, they get crushed. And so that is a very profound insight. And it's one that most people in marketing, most people in entrepreneurship, and certainly most people in podcasting are not aware of. So once you realize that, oh, and here, there's one other thing that's really important. For my first book, Play Bigger, we did some data science research. And we looked at every venture-backed technology company founded in the United States from 2000 through to 2015. And we measured the growth in their value over time as measured by market capitalization. And we asked the following question of the data set. In any given market category, what percent of the total value created as measured by market cap or valuation, goes to the leader, aka the category queen or king? And here's the aha, and we published this research in the Harvard Business Review. 76% of the total value created in a category goes to the category queen. So when you realize these facts, there's this aha that happens, and the aha goes like this. The company that designs and dominates the space takes 2/3 of the economics. The people who are trying to copy that company fight over 1/3 of the economics at best. And in some market categories, it's more dramatic than that. So what does that mean? In order to be legendary at anything, we have to become known for a niche or a category that we own. What makes Pablo Picasso Pablo Picasso is not that he's a great painter. What makes Pablo Picasso a legend is he's the creator of a new type, a new category of painting called cubism. All right, so what does all this have to do with podcasting? Before we launch a podcast, we must ask ourselves the question, what problem does this podcast solve? For whom does it solve this problem? How is it different in addressing this problem than every other podcast out there? And if it's not different, we're in for a world of pain here. And then after that, why does that difference matter? And we manifest that in what's called a point of view. So the big questions are, what problem does this podcast solve? What makes it different? Why does that different matter? And to whom does it matter? And then from there, we build this thing called a point of view, which evangelizes the problem and positions us as the solution. And when the world understands the point of view, then they will understand why you're different, why you're a new category, and why you matter. And if that understanding tips at any kind of a scale, you'll have a super successful podcast. And if it doesn't, you'll just be another podcast with a bunch of people talking or doing whatever it is you're doing.
Right, right. You end up being the also ran podcast of the, you know, the whole ecosystem. But I know you're not a big fan of personal branding or social media influencers, but do you think this category design or creating a category also applies to individuals as well, Chris?
Absolutely. It applies to your career. The only path to a legendary career is to produce legendary results, to build a reputation, and ultimately to become known for a niche that you own. I'll give you a simple example. There are gazillions of great journalists. And in the United States in the 60s and 70s, there was a journalist working for Rolling Stone magazine who had a very distinctive style. He was at the center of music and drug culture in the United States. And his name is Hunter S. Thompson. And he wrote about all sorts of crazy adventures, shall we say. And he published a lot of this stuff in Rolling Stone magazine when Rolling Stone magazine was one of the hottest magazines in the English language world. Now, what made Hunter S. Thompson such a famous writer in America and many other places? He was the first gonzo journalist. That was the category of journalism that he was leading in. So he wasn't just another journalist. He wasn't just another music journalist. He wasn't just another counterculture journalist. He was the world's first gonzo journalist. And that category is what made Hunter S. Thompson, just like Cubism is what made Picasso. And so if you are a dentist, well, what type of dentist do you want to be? Do you want to be just another generic dentist? Or do you want to be the number one dentist in a particular type of procedure in your area? That's called a niche down. That's called becoming known for a niche that you own.
Right. What category do you think you've created for yourself, Chris?
That's a great question. Well, here's if you want to get really meta with me, here's the fun thing about this. The thing that I am most known for is being one of the creators, one of the quote-unquote godfathers of category design.
That's exactly the reason why I asked you this question, because when I come to think of a category for you, I can't think of anything else but category design, which is so meta, like you put it.
Well, yeah, because in wanting to educate the world about the power of the category lens, the power of this idea of category design, the radical concept that it's one thing to compete in a market and it's a whole other thing to create the market. And those of us who compete at the start, the minute we are comparing ourselves to somebody else, the minute we say we are going to capture demand that was created by somebody else, we are playing somebody else's game. We've lost before we've started. That's a radical idea. That is fundamentally what category design is. And there's something crazy about being an educator in category design, wanting to give the world this lens, this new management discipline. And at the same time, by doing such, creating a category for yourself as one of the godfathers of category design.
Exactly. Yeah, you're so right. Now, I want to take, a contrary point of view here, although I'm convinced with the law of category that says it's better to be first than it is to be better. But I cannot also help thinking if it's a long-term sustainable marketing strategy, because if I think about it from the point of view of the examples that you keep quoting, let's say Netflix or Spanx that you keep bringing up in your talks, right? I mean, during the initial years of this brand's growth, they might get the mind share in people's heads because they position themselves as a unique, never been done different products. But later, as these brands or companies grow, I think the categories get watered down because people start seeing your product for what it is and not how you position them. I mean, the control goes out of your hand. I mean, Netflix just becomes another way to watch TV series, or Spanx becomes a fancy leggings for women, or Safeway, or whatever the hell it is. But over a period of time, you might lose control of your positioning, just like I said earlier, and because other players like media or analyst firms start boxing you in categories that they think is suitable for you. For example, Gartner Magic Quadrants, you know, categorize software in whatever way it is convenient for them. So what I'm trying to ask you here is category design a sustainable marketing strategy, or is it just one of those growth hacking techniques that will get you initial traction, initial momentum?
Yeah, I'm going to say this in an overly simplified way. It's not 100% true, but I have no interest in growth hacking. Growth hacking, for the most part, is bullshit. And look, are there some things that can be done to drive some downloads or to drive some purchase? Sure. But most of those things are tricks. And it's fine to use tricks from time to time. But that's not who I am. That's not what I do. So category design is absolutely a long-term strategy. And when you choose a category design and you execute against it, at a minimum, you should be thinking there's a five-year commitment you just made. At a minimum. Now, let's get to the point you were making about they can get watered down. Here's why they get watered down. When the category queen or king stops evangelizing the category. So I'll give you an example of one that hasn't been watered down, one that has grown exponentially in the tech world, and that's the cloud. And if you go back to the late 90s, when Salesforce.com launched, I credit Mark Benioff for being the category designer of the cloud. He actually wasn't first, and this is an important distinction. A lot of people confuse category design, category creation with first to market. First to market doesn't mean shit. It's the first to get the design of the category to tip at scale. So to the best of my knowledge, Mark Benioff was not even the first person to say the word cloud. I believe that person was Marc Andreessen, the creator of the first commercial web browser. Anyway, regardless of that, Marc Benioff is single-handedly responsible for the new category of cloud computing. Now, that was approximately 25 years ago, maybe a little less, but you know, in late 90s. If you listen to him today, gentlemen, what do you hear him talk about? Cloud, 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 cloud. And he may be talking about it for a certain thing. You know, they just went out and bought Slack. So now he's going to start talking about social business, social network, collaboration software and communicate. You know, so he's going to talk about that. But he bought the cloud leader in that, in Slack. And so my point is the following. Legendary entrepreneurs, legendary creators, legendary innovators are evangelists for the category, because the category is about the problem. The category is about the opportunity. Categories are about customers. Brands are about products and companies. And it's the leaders who stay focused on the problem, stay focused on what the opportunity could be, a different kind of future for the customer. It's those people who are category designers. In the most recent acquisition of Slack, if you look at the quotes from Benioff, all he's talking about is creating the future of work. Okay, and so this is what legendary category designers do. And so, yes, can a category get stale? Absolutely. And the reason categories get stale generally is because the category queen or king, stops evangelizing the category. In the event where they keep evangelizing the category and they do what legendary category designers do, which is expand the market category for everybody. Elon Musk is creating a whole new space for other auto manufacturers. He's not just creating one for him. Matter of fact, he gave away all of his patents to welcome competition to the market category that he's designing because he knows he needs more people in the market category than just him. And so my point is, legends take responsibility for the growth and creation of the category itself, not just their product, company, or brand.
Yeah, I absolutely love that point. In fact, the moment you said cloud and you spoke about Mark Benioff, I could not just help myself think about, that's the same thing Steve Jobs did with smartphones. You know, he's not the first guy to invent, but yeah, everybody, the moment they think of smartphones, the first person they think of is Steve Jobs. Right. So, Chris, moving back to the topic of podcasts, you are amongst the world's top 1% podcasters. And I love the part where, on one of your podcasts, you said any brand who doesn't have a podcast is insane. I want to talk about that. At that very moment, Manish and I both thought we must have Chris on the show. So, we also think that podcast is going through that phase that blogging went through during the late 90s or early 2000s. I mean, it's very popular and it has its advantages, but yet a lot of people and brands are shy about giving it a try. In fact, it is just another form of content marketing. But why do you think that brands are still resisting to adopt podcasts as part of their marketing when the barrier to entry is so low? And what kind of future do you think podcasts have, especially in business and marketing, and where is it headed towards?
So listen, I'm a podcast zealot. So now I also happen to be a three-time public company CMO. I think if you don't have a podcast today from a marketing perspective as a company, you're insane. It's like not having a website. And the reason I say that is to build a legendary category, never mind becoming the dominant brand and company in that category, you have to create a movement. We did an episode recently of my marketing podcast with a guy named David Sachs. And David is a legendary Silicon Valley entrepreneur and investor. He was the founder, co-founder of PayPal with Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and those guys. He was a seed investor in Facebook, in Uber, and in many others. He's had an extraordinary career, both as an entrepreneur and as an investor. His company, Yammer, that he was founding CEO of, he sold to Microsoft for in excess of $1 billion. This is a guy who knows what's up. And we had a conversation recently about a fantastic blog post that he wrote that I highly recommend. And I believe the title is Your Startup is a Movement. And what Sachs's point is that legendary founders, legendary entrepreneurs, they create a movement. They're creating a change. In Play Bigger, we talk about how they're moving the world from the way it is to the way they want it to be. And that's what they're doing. And so if you're a company that is trying to create a different future, trying to move things exponentially forward, trying to make a contribution that heretofore has not been made, then one of the things it behooves you to do is carry the flag for that idea. Be at the front of that parade, create what Sachs calls a movement around this idea. And if you create a big movement, then you're going to create a big market category. And if you're the person creating the market category, you're the person that's going to take 2/3 of the economics in that market category. And even if you don't want to look at it from purely a financial or economic perspective, look, if you're a creator or you're an inventor, an innovator of any kind, if you want people to experience your innovation, you want people to enjoy your creation, whether it's a piece of art or a piece of software or whatever it is. And so the more you can introduce and educate people about this new idea, this new thing, this new area you're pioneering, the more broadly people will get it and the bigger the difference that you can make. And so I just think if you are any kind of business, any kind of innovator, any kind of creator, and certainly if you're in the B2B tech space, you are absolutely insane if you aren't being an evangelist. I think the E in CEO stands for evangelist. And so creating legendary content that evangelizes your point of view for this future you're trying to help create and design, and being a catalyst for thinking around a set of topics that you think are super important for the world, that's just a smart thing to do. That's a fun thing to do. It's a cool thing to do, to be one of the people or one of the companies in your industry that is helping to coalesce the greatest thinking. Why wouldn't you want to be part of that conversation?
Right, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. But you know, the problem that I have is a lot of people are looking at podcasting as a way to actually make money, which I definitely don't agree with. I mean, they get carried away by taking the Joe Rogans and Tim Ferriss of the world as an example. I mean, you do make money as a podcaster if you have sponsors, but you know, that's not the first choice that comes to your mind. You know, when you think of money making as an option, there are several other options through which you can actually make money. So the thing is, you know, having spoken about everybody needs to be on a podcast to evangelize, but what are some of the wrong reasons to get into podcasting? And according to you, you know, what should be a good motive of actually starting and running a podcast in the long run?
Such a great question. This is probably the most important question for podcasters, whether they're independent podcasters or you're the CEO or CMO or a co-founder or what have you of a company and you're thinking of starting one for the company. My friend and collaborator on many projects and many articles for Harvard Business Review is a guy named Eddie Yoon. He's written a fantastic book called Super Consumers. And Eddie has written more about category design for the Harvard Business Review than any person alive or dead. He's unbelievable. And he draws this very, very powerful lens on this. He draws the distinction between missionaries and mercenaries. And if you are a missionary for a cause, then you will do anything for that cause because you believe in it. You care about it. You want the world to be different in some meaningful way. You want to move the world forward. You want to make a contribution. And missionaries tend to be at least a little, if not a lot, radical. And they tend to be the people who move the world. And so if you're a missionary and you really believe in what you're doing, why not have a podcast to talk about that? Why not talk to other people who are working in the field? Why not talk to customers who are doing things in this domain, other partners, people in adjacent categories, university professors, journalists, authors, other business thinkers, whatever the adjacencies are? Wouldn't you want to be part of forwarding the thinking around a topic that you care about? As a matter of fact, it's crazy to me to think that you wouldn't. And so I think the answer to the question is, if you are a missionary, then you should do a podcast as part of your strategy to evangelize what you believe is important. If you're a mercenary and you're just trying to make a quick buck, okay, hey man, there's nothing wrong with making money. I'm all for it. I'm a capitalist. At the same time, doing a podcast well is no different than doing anything else well. It takes commitment. It takes time. It takes investment. It takes preparation. It takes marketing. It takes creating a highly differentiated product. It takes positioning that product as unique and distinct in at least, if not a new category, certainly a very tight niche. And then it takes a lot of consistency and a lot of time to make it work. There is no secret to success. It's no different in podcasting than it is in building a software company, than it is in any other thing you want to go get done. Yes, are there the rare get-rich-quick, instant, viral, overnight successes? Sure there are. But the vast majority of people who are successful, that's not how they get there in any domain. And so I think that's fundamentally the headset. If you're a missionary and you believe in what you're up to, then podcasting is an incredible medium. Now, by the way, some people aren't talkers, and maybe you're not the right person to have the podcast, but somebody else in your company is, or somebody who's also committed to the mission is, and maybe you're a better writer or whatever it is. That's fine too. It might not be the right medium for you as an individual, but in general, if you're trying to forward an agenda that matters and you don't have a podcast about it, you've made a fundamental mistake, in my opinion.
Right. That is such a great, such a great analogy between missionary and mercenary. And all of a sudden, I feel better about not making money out of our ABM Conversation podcast. And I feel like I'm a member of the missionary. So good thing to be radically opinionated about it. My next question to you, Chris, is not going to be about podcasting at all, but I want to shift gears and talk to you about something else. Maybe it's a little bit tilted towards entrepreneurship, because I think you've seen all the four seasons of Silicon Valley startups. You have been an entrepreneur for a long time before you officially retired in double quotes from that title. And as a three-time CMO of public companies, you have also seen the ebbs and flows that happen when you take a small startup and grow it big enough for it to be acquired by the likes of Hewlett and Packard, right? So based on all that you have seen in your career, spanning as a small-time hospital orderly in a Toronto, in a city like Toronto, to being the godfather of category design, now enjoying life in beautiful beaches of Santa Cruz. What I want to ask you next is, would you rather start a company from scratch, or do you prefer to take a small company and grow it to a multi-million dollar profitable business? Which one do you find more arousing and why?
It's a great question. And I'll share with you the lens that I use for making any decision to do any professional thing. So I don't look at it as, am I starting a company or joining a company? I've started companies in my life. I've joined companies as a CMO in my life. I've been on boards and I've advised, more than 50 venture-backed companies. So I've sort of seen it from virtually every standpoint. Here's the lens that I use. It isn't joining or starting a company. The lens I use is, what is the category potential here? And if the chance to do something legendary, to create a whole new market category, to bring a legendary innovation to the world and make a difference and build a highly valuable company that endures and delivers massive value for all of its constituents, its community, its employees, of course, its customers, and its investors and its partners, right? If you say, look, we want to do this, and this is why, for example, I was so excited to do the Conscious VC podcast with Naveen Chowda at Mayfield. Here you have one of the top VCs in Silicon Valley talking about how important it is to have a mindset around not just making money, but doing good things in the world for people, for the economy broadly, for the environment, that it's time for businesses to take a very broad perspective. And we recently had John Chambers on Conscious VC. John, to get to your question, he wasn't the founder of Cisco Systems, but he became the CEO of Cisco Systems after joining the company as the head of sales and field operations. And ultimately, he became the CEO that not just built Cisco Systems, but he built really what you could call the internet infrastructure category of the time, starting with the router and moving beyond that. And then even further to the missionary discussion we just had, I like to describe John Chambers as the prime minister of the internet. Because back in the 90s and early 2000s, if you sat in the audience while John was presenting at a Wall Street conference or a technology conference, as I did, and watched him give those presentations, he didn't speak like he was just the CEO of Cisco, which was one of the most important companies in the history of the technology industry. He spoke like the prime minister of the internet. And so all that is to say, I think when you really look at this thing, for people who are on a mission, this is the broad perspective that they're trying to take. They're trying to build something beyond themselves and even, dare I say, beyond their own company.
Right. That is amazing. Totally love that, the way you put it. That's a great story. Since we are right now hitting or inching towards the 40-minute mark, it's time for rapid-fire questions. So are you ready for that?
I'm ready if you guys are.
All right. So here's rapid fire question number one. Here's a quote that we picked up from your Twitter. You said, new categories are only obvious in hindsight. Can you expand that?
Yes. 25 years ago, if you did a focus group and you asked people, would you be willing to pay for bottled water? The answer would be no.
Absolutely.
Today, it's a multi-billion dollar category. And we most recently had Kara Golden on my Dialogue podcast. And she's the founder of Hint Water. And she started the company with $50,000. And the company is a massive success today. They've created a whole new category in bubbly, healthy, fruit-flavored water here in America. And she's an incredibly successful entrepreneur, one of the most successful in the beverage industry, and frankly, in the food industry. And she's rapidly rising as one of the most admired entrepreneurs in the country. And so, and this is in a new market category that when was originally being designed, absolutely everybody said they wouldn't pay for. That's point A. Point B, nobody, absolutely nobody wanted a horseless carriage. None of them. Zero. As a matter of fact, Henry Ford famously said, if I'd listened to my customers, I would have built a faster horse. Zero billion dollar market category. And more recently, you know, earlier we were talking about the cloud and Mark Benioff. In 1997, the idea that major corporations, major financial institutions, major government agencies, major nonprofits would move all of their data, all of their technology, or the vast majority of their technology stack, to a third-party off-premise site where they didn't even know where their freaking data was, that wasn't going to happen. There was almost 1,000% opposition to the cloud in 1997. And today, it is considered the de facto standard for how we do computing. And I would even take it a step further. In 2020, one of the things we learned, data is an essential service. In 2020, we learned the internet is an essential service and the cloud is the essential is an essential service. Think about what humankind would have had to go through to deal with this virus in the absence of the cloud, in the absence of data and the internet, right? Clearly, information technology is making that level of a difference right now. And so, yeah, that's what I think about that.
Yeah, absolutely love that. You know, ever since we got into the lockdown, I don't remember a day without Zoom. So yeah, that's absolutely true what you said.
Those things are only obvious in hindsight. When Mark Benioff was evangelizing the cloud, most people in tech thought he was insane. They shat all over him for years, right? And that's true of almost every legendary entrepreneur. A major Coke executive was misogynistic and derogatory towards Kara Golden when she was starting her company, telling her why it would never work. We're just dropping an episode of my marketing podcast right now about this, which is when you're designing a new category, be very careful who you listen to, because most people can't see the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't agree more. In fact, 10 or 12 years back, I still remember myself, you know, representing an IT security company and writing that cloud is not secure. That was the position that we had to take. Funny enough, right? When back, things have changed.
My, have they not? Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so true, so true. All right, so moving to question number two. This is going to be interesting. What is the worst pitch that you've ever received through your social media DMs?
Oh, God, the last one I got. They're all terrible. And here's something that I actually want to ask you guys. When the fuck did it become standard to do the following? You send somebody a DM, email, tweet, whatever it is. You start off with a bullshit, clearly insincere compliment over something. Then you start puking about why your shit is awesome. And then you start asking the person to do a bunch of stuff like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could have a conversation? I got this one recently. You might have seen my post. Exactly this format. Bullshit, completely disingenuous compliment. Start going off about their company. Then tell me I need to book an appointment with them because their thing is really awesome. Then tell me that I should also have them on my podcast. And then tell them, here's a link that would be really cool if you shared on social media. Can't wait to talk to you. Are you out of your fucking mind? It's crazy. And so this disingenuous approach is disgusting. It's, look, and I can tell you, as somebody who's on the receiving end of this thing all day, every day, what I'm trying to do, candidly, is to not be jaded when somebody reaches out on social media. Because when I get a tweet or a LinkedIn or what have you, and somebody says, oh, I really love your podcast or your book or whatever, I sit there and I go, okay, here it's coming any minute now. There's going to be some bullshit here. They're going to try to sell me their fucking thing, or they're going to, you know, whatever it is. And it's the equivalent of walking up to a woman in a bar and saying, hey, I think you're really good looking. Why don't we get married? And what do you think we should name our kids? Like, you would never do that in the real world, right? And so, yeah, people are insane on social media about this. And, you know, look, I know we are fortunate. We are fortunate that our inboxes are bombarded, and it takes me and Candace to go through all this stuff. And we are also very fortunate that many of the top writers in the world, many of the top entrepreneurs in the world authentically do reach out. And we're lucky enough to have them join us for an episode. So that's the positive side is, you know, I get some miracle emails from some pretty legendary people who are asking to come on the podcast, and they do it in a very professional way. And that's awesome. And we deeply appreciate that. Unfortunately, that's probably, you know, 2% of it, and 98% of it is absolute garbage, and worse than garbage, it's disingenuous. You know, it's this fake praise. It's just I don't know how that became the standard for marketing over the internet, but it's got to stop.
Right. Can't agree more. You know, it's that template. It's people start to, sometimes the worst part is people start to pitch slap the moment they get connected. And to me, you know, the moment I get a connection, straight away, I get a pitch for, this is what my company does. Do you want to buy? I'm like, this is even more insane. All right. So question number three. So what's your tip, or probably a set of tips, for podcasters like us, you know, who are looking to grow their audience in a specific niche and become the best?
Well, that's a great question. You said the magic word. So the first one is, what's the niche, right? That getting very, very clear about that really matters. And once we know what the niche is, that starts to tell us things. Niche also equals problem/opportunity. So the problem we solve, or the opportunity we're exposing. And then as we go from there, we say, okay, well, who are the kinds of people that are interested in either A, solving this problem, / B, exploiting this opportunity? And then you ask yourself, okay, well, where do those people hang out? And then you want to be where those people hang out. So it's not rocket surgery. The thing that's important to understand, I think, is play the long game and realize there's going to be a lot of experimentation. So there's lots of things that can work. But here's the thing that I've found. It's really a culmination of things. And here's what I mean. One of the top things, of course, you can do is be a guest on other podcasts. Because when you're a guest on other podcasts, the people listening already consume podcasts. One of the challenges when you go to market a podcast is not everybody listens to them, right? And so if you're marketing to people who don't listen to podcasts, first, you got to sell them on the idea of the podcast. Then they got to be willing to try your podcast. When we guest on a podcast, the audience that we're guesting for is clearly listening to us on a podcast. So we have an opportunity to grow that way. I think you have to look at where you are most comfortable being, where your audience is most likely. So, you know, in my case, I've tried a bunch of stuff. So I'm reasonably active on Quora. I think that's a wonderful place. I enjoy it myself, consuming content there. And I enjoy being a content creator there. It's a question and answer site. And, you know, I've been involved for many years. I don't write a ton as much as I podcast, but of course I do write. And, you know, my work has been consumed about 1 million times on Quora. So that's a lot of exposure. You know, then there are other blogging platforms like Medium, like LinkedIn. For whatever reason, I've had more success on LinkedIn than I have had on other social platforms. So great. I spend more time on LinkedIn than others. I sort of focus more there. Obviously, I'm an author of 2 books. And so there's a whole set of things that you do, right? You're on podcasts, you're writing. I've written for major publications of late, most notably kind of Harvard Business Review. But in the past, I've written for Forbes and Fortune and CBSNews.com and so forth and so on. And so getting your work published fairly broadly is a very powerful thing. And so I really think what you're doing is you're sort of building what you might think of as a flywheel. You start showing up in lots of places that appeal to the kinds of people that you're trying to appeal to. You're very clear about what your niche is. You're very clear about what your point of view is. And then you just get in the mix. And then you play the long game. You realize that the number of people who have overnight viral success is very weak, is very few, rather. And that this is going to take a while. My first book, Play Bigger, came out now 4.5 years ago. And we found out about a year ago, so approximately 3.5 years in, that we had broken into the top 1% of business books sold. Now, you might look at it and go, well, shit, that was took 3.5 years to make that happen, which is not sort of the instant hustle porn star, buy my course and you'll be an overnight sensation bullshit that we get sold a lot today on social media. It's not that. It's the opposite of that. At the same time, when you think about 3.5 years over the course of a life, it's not that much. And now we're 4.5 years into this broad conversation category design, which is what was launched in the book. And I'm more excited about learning about category design, hearing what other people are doing with it. There's lots of other people who are writing and researching and university professors and entrepreneurs doing things with category design, writing things on category design, et cetera, et cetera. I'm more excited about the topic today than I ever have been before. And there's more people working on it and doing shit with it. And so, you know, I think that's the other thing. You have to have a mission that you're on that is a mission that is worthy of your life. And if it's something you really care about, you're going to be 4 years into it, 5 years into it, and you'll be more stoked about it than you were when you started. And this idea of playing long game then becomes okay. It's like, look, this is what I want to do. And so... so it took 3.5 years to get to the top 1% of business book sales. Okay. And by the way, that was a legendary outcome. You're talking to a dyslexic kid that didn't go to college. And so that was a game worth playing. And we did something really special. And I'm proud of us. And so the question really is, as you go forward on this stuff, what's a mission that is worth your life? And are you willing to play the long game? And if you are, then get out there and find ways of communicating and sharing and learning and elevating others. I try super hard to promote other people that I think are doing legendary work in the areas that I care about. And then just play the long game. And you know what? Here's the other aha. We get sold that success is about achieving a destination. And the truth is, the journey is the destination. It's fun that you get to do it. And hopefully we get some results along the way. And if you're lucky and you're smart and you execute, you can be super successful at something. But the reality is, as somebody who's been on the other side of success a couple times, what I could tell you is the real gift, the real joy is not any particular result, is not being on a magazine cover or achieving a, those things are important. I get that. But what's more important is that you get to play a game that you love. And ideally you get to do it with people that you love and you feel like you're absolutely making a difference and you're enjoying it along the way. If you get that, then whatever the results are, that's all great.
You know, I can't tell you, I'm sure Manish is also smiling right now because, you know, you exactly spoke our mind. Both of us, when we started this podcast, the first thing we said to each other is, we'll do it as long as we are enjoying and let's not worry about the results. And funny enough, you know, we never went about getting our guests until the first 14 or 15 episodes. And, you know, much later, our guest episode started. And the other part is, of course, we did have a lot of people come to us with pitches like, you know, I'll give you so many downloads, so many bot downloads, blah, blah, blah. And we said, you know, that's not what we want to do. We want to actually make a difference to the life of B2B marketers. And our core was like, we'll talk about problems that people face on a day-to-day basis and address that, than, you know, going about the number of downloads or trying to make it number one very soon.
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of really important things about that, Yag. The first one is, I have never paid for a review, a download, or a book sale ever. So there's lots of ways to game this system. You know, in the book business, by way of example, you can pay, there are firms out there that you can pay approximately $250,000 to. Maybe the price has gone up, but that was the price at the time when Play Bigger came out. You can pay, at the time we were told, we could pay a firm $250,000 and they could virtually guarantee our presence on the New York Times bestseller list because they know how much you have to sell and they know what bookstores and various outlets the New York Times is monitoring. And they essentially have, their promise was, we know how to rig the system, and for $250,000, we can guarantee you that. That's one example of what you can do. On social media, of course, you can buy followers, you can buy downloads, you can buy reviews, you can buy all these things. And a lot of these people that you see that have giant social media followings, they have paid for those things. And so I made the decision a long time ago. It's just not who I am. I'm not interested in any of that. That to me is complete bullshit. I am not interested in playing a game of deceit with myself or anyone else. So fuck that. I'm going to go out, I'm going to do my thing. And here's the crazy thing about whether it's book sales or downloads or any of these metrics. When you feel like they're too low, you can have this, woe is me, you know, we're not selling many books or we're not doing many podcast downloads or, you know, such and such has 1 million downloads a minute or 12 million downloads, you know, and we only have two, you know, whatever. You can get into that woe is me place when you don't think the book sales or the downloads or whatever the fucking metric is enough. Here's the other side of it. We didn't know what Play Bigger sales were for essentially until a year ago. We got very little data. The book industry is masterful at not telling you what's going on. And one of my co-authors decided approximately about a year ago that this was ridiculous. And so he started working with our various publishers around the world to try to figure out how much we'd actually fucking sold. And that's how we found out that we had made it. Well, here's what happens when you discover that, you know, you broke out. Then you have this conversation with yourself, which is, holy shit, I had no idea that many people were going to consume this thing. I don't know if we should have just done that or said that or written that. And so here's my point, guys. The download / sales numbers / chart number, all that. Look, is it important? Do we all want to be successful? Do we all want to sell our books and have great downloads? Of course we do. And having achieved some of that in my life, those are great things. But you sort of can never win. It drives you crazy the whole time. You're either not doing enough in comparison to somebody else in your own mind, or you've done well and now you're freaked out because your audience is so big. You know, we just had Sharon Vaughn on Follow Your Different. She's an incredible songwriter. She's written music for Dolly Parton and all these giant, Willie Nelson, all these giant performers. And she was telling me how painful it is when you write a song and it starts climbing up the charts, because every day it's not at number one, but it's getting closer to number one. You're starting to worry, well, you know, we get to number seven and never make it to number one. So it's just the whole ride up is painful. And then when you hit it, the only thing that anybody cares about after that is, okay, well, how long were you at number one? And then you can get tortured about that. So my point in all this is, it's great to have goals. It's great to achieve some of those goals. But you can make yourself crazy about all those things. And if you're more of a missionary, you learn over time your download numbers or your book sales numbers or whatever other your metrics are. I don't look at those things. I look at them maybe once a quarter, and then I just do what I do.
Right. As someone, as someone who has published 7 books myself, so I can't agree more. You know, I know how many people, just place their book in the wrong category and call themselves bestsellers. So, you know, my next question to you is going to be very much related to that. So books or podcasts, in your view, what's more fun to create and why?
I don't compare them that way, candidly, Yag. I think they're both really fun for different reasons. Fundamentally, for me, they're the same idea. But I love doing both. I think podcasting is easier for me. I'm a talker, obviously, and I'm dyslexic. And so reading and writing is a big commitment to me. At the same time, just like with anything that you love, you can get into a flow with it. And, you know, sometimes I'll sit down at the computer and I'll look at the clock, and in what feels like 5 minutes, 3 hours has gone by, and all of a sudden a whole bunch of cool stuff has come out of my fingers into a document. And so I love both of them for slightly different reasons. And I'm just, you know, just feel super grateful that I can be a person that creates stuff, and hopefully stuff that makes a difference for others.
Right. Beautifully said. And here's the final rapid fire question. You know, what's that one thing that you can say today about business, marketing, or life in general, for that matter, that you think will kick the ass of people listening to this right now in the typical Christopher Lockett style?
Yeah. So I'm not sure if this has been widely seen in India yet, but very recently, the American Time magazine came out and named 2020 as the worst year ever. And hard to argue, certainly the worst year in modern history, for all the reasons that are self-evident. And in the case of our family, we've had some huge tragedies that happen that are not connected to the pandemic and the recession and the battle for racial equality here in the United States, and all the things that we all understand have happened around the world. So here's what I'd tell you that most people aren't going to tell you. If you want to do something legendary with your career, if you're somebody who says, hey, listen, I want to do things that are worthy of my talent. We don't know what happens in the afterlife, but what we do know is we have an opportunity to optimize this life for ourselves, for our family and friends, and for our community and for our world. And so if you're somebody who wants to make a difference, if you're somebody who wants to move things forward in anywhere near an exponential way, if you're somebody who wants to have what you might think of as a legendary career and make a big difference in the world, as opposed to somebody who just sort of wants to, you know, get by and collect a paycheck and go home, which, by the way, is fine. That's fine. Not everybody has to be up to something giant. I get that. But some of us are pulled in that direction. So if you're that kind of person, here's what I would let you know. There's going to be some massive pain and suffering. There's going to be some horrible failure. My first business failed. I've been involved with many, many failures. I've been on the edge of personal bankruptcy. I've been the butt of many, many jokes. I have felt publicly humiliated. I have been at companies that got investigated by the federal government for financial wrongdoing. I've been fucked over by people for giant amounts of money. People who told me they loved me like they were my family. And these are the things that you're not going to hear very often. If you want to have a career doing things that are legendary, that are exponential, you're going to meet a lot of resistance. You're going to have failure. You're going to have heartbreak. And some of it's going to be fucking horrible. A dear friend of mine right now is going through a horrible business breakup. Absolutely terrible. And so shit happens. If you're in business with your family, if you're in business with your friends, that comes with a whole other thing. And so forth and so on. And what I'll tell you, it's all worth it anyway. Go for it anyway. And the reason is, if you can train yourself to be a person who can be counted on to produce legendary results in the face of extraordinary odds, if you want to train yourself to be somebody who can come back from deep personal, professional, or financial pain and loss, and continue to create and move things forward in our world, that's a worthy pursuit. No one gets out of here alive, and no one gets out of here without some pain. And that shit's going to happen, and it's going to fucking suck. Getting divorced sucks. Having a business go down sucks. Getting fucked over by business partners you thought were your friends and family really sucks. Those things are going to happen, or some variant thereof. We're all going to lose our parents. Shit's going to happen in life. My point is, traversing all of it is worth it. There are things in life that we have to go through because we can't go around them. And there's joy on the other side. Because if you are a person of substance who's making a contribution, you're going to have a legendary life, and it will be worth whatever you have to go through. And so, as somebody who's been through a lot of pain, suffering, and humiliating failure, I could tell you there's light on the other side.
That was really a deep, a very passionate and moving ending, our climax to the show. Thank you so much for saying that. And I think, you know, you've covered the answer for the next question that I had when I took over from Yag, which is the parting message to the audience, which I think you have done apt justice to it. So I'm not going to ask you for another parting message. I think that does the job, and hats off to you for that message. I just have one more question before we let you go for the rest of the day, which is where can people find you online if they want to connect to you or have follow-up questions for you?
Yeah, the simplest thing, everything hangs off my website, and that's just lockhead.com, L-O-C-H, and then another H-E-A-D.com. And then all my other, the books and podcasts and social connections and anything else you might want to have hangs off lockhead.com.
Amazing. This has been a great show, Chris. I mean, we loved it. And I don't think we have covered everything that we wanted to, but we want to be respectful of your time and the time of our listeners. So maybe we'll have a round two going forward in the future. But thank you for coming and joining us tonight on the show, and to the listeners of our podcast. We will catch you on the next episode of the AVM Conversations podcast. Until then, this is me, Anish, signing off.
And this is Bai from me, Yag. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.